How will we tell the story of what we've been through? Some of us are probably taking a minute every now and then to think about that. Maybe some of you are even writing things down, taking pictures, saving things. It happens a lot, right? When we move through troubled times, we save the headline from the newspaper and they show up in antique stores later. Maybe some of us are journaling, creating diaries, imagining our future selves or future family or people that will come across our account of what we've been through here. It's a way we make sense of the times we're in to try to frame it, to tell its story for future selves. And it's one of the reasons why I love the book of Acts, is because the book of Acts is just that. It's a story of someone who wants to make sure and get the story down of a remarkable time. The writer of Acts, perhaps in conversation with others, has been through an incredible change, a ground-shaking change. The world's most powerful and vicious empire of Rome appears to be shaking, and shaking due to the least likely disturbance in this small little province in Palestine, one of many, many occupied spaces with one of the least warlike people of any of the warlike peoples, and in that people, a group of fishermen and widows and some of the scrappiest, poorest people imaginable are living in a way that's causing emperors to shake in their boots. It's a terrible time because there's also great persecution and people are seeing miracles, they're seeing whole other ways of living, and they're also seeing great death and suffering. And so I can't draw a direct analogy between what the church was going through then, this people was going through then, and what we're going through now, but it's certainly dramatic in similar ways, certainly life-changing for the people going through it. The world was changing. And so in Acts, we see someone trying to tell the story. And whenever someone tries to tell the story, we see as much of them as the story itself, right? Any history is an attempt to make sense of things. Each history brings its own perspective, certain aspects of events that the historian wants to bring out because the historian has a point of view. The historian has a part of things that she especially wants to be kept. So yes, she's taking count. She's writing names. She's figuring out who was there, checking it with people. I can imagine a writer of Acts sharing a draft with others, perhaps. I can imagine the writer of Acts checking with others and saying, "Hey, I remember it happened this way. Is this about what you remember too?" And so, sure, there's probably some collective dimension to how this book came about. But still, I enjoy reading it the way I enjoy watching a film, which was made by a collective, but films always have a point of view. And in this first chapter of Acts, it is quite film-like. And there's some incredible sweeps of camera through this sequence. There's some themes here that persist throughout the rest of the book. And I want to think today a little about these themes and how the themes that the writer of Acts pulled out might offer some themes for us to pull out in the way we try to make sense of the story we're living through. Now, a first theme I see here in chapter 1. And again, we're not moving through Acts again. We've done that before in Bible studies for this church. We're just reading this because it's part of the lectionary today. But I see in this theme, first of all, this very interesting one that, of course, I would pull out if you've heard my talks before, which is a theme of time set against space, of history set against landscape. Now, of course, a book would deal with history. Of course, a book might begin with themes about time, because it is a history, and history is about time. But here in verse 6 of chapter 1, you see the historian, the writer, representing his friends, his community, as also preoccupied with time. And they all say, "Lord, is this the time when you will restore the kingdom to Israel?" It's like they're saying, we've been reading histories, we've been reading prophecies, we've been understanding ourselves as within a certain story. Is now that part of the story we've been thinking we're going to? And if not, where are we? Where are we in your story, Lord, is what the followers are saying. It's a totally understandable question. And aren't we asking that ourselves too? Aren't we also asking, where are we in the story? Are we at the end of something? Are we at the beginning of something? We sure want to know. That's for sure. We want to know, are we at the end of the story of this pandemic? Is it over? That's so much of the hope of opening up again, the economy opening, of our spaces opening, is a hope that we're at the end of a story. We want to know so badly where we are and what's going to happen next. And so these disciples do as well in Acts chapter 1. They say, is this the time? Is this the end? We see something shaking here. We've seen death defeated. We've seen an empire try to take down the teacher that was showing us the way, the teacher that reminded us of every great prophet we've ever heard about. And maybe this is the time when the Messiah that we have learned about and passed down over the generations as a story of liberation is finally going to make things happen. And Jesus, the resurrected Jesus, Jesus of this very strange new kind of body that is both fleshly and not, answers, it's not for you to know the times or periods that the Father has set. So Jesus is saying, I know you want to know about what history is. I know you want to know where you are in time, but now's not the time for that, and you're not the person to know that. What a thing for a historian to write, right? What a thing for a writer of a history book to set out saying, nope, you can't really know where you are in history. I love that. It's such a great self-conscious move there right at the beginning. And then Jesus does cast something forward in the future, in the near future, and says, you will receive power when the Holy Spirit has come upon you, and you will be my witnesses in Jerusalem and all Judea and Samaria and to the ends of the earth. And what an amazing pivot that is. Again, I like to think of cinema here and points of view. Where is the camera? Are we supposed to identify with the camera? Who's in the camera? Who's in the frame? This is a pivot of point of view here. You can imagine the disciples imagining a long parade of history, a timeline of history, a timeline, and they want to know, where are we in it? And Jesus instead says, you can't really know that, but you are going to receive something. Stop looking at what else is before or after you. Something's going to come to you. The Holy Spirit is going to come to you, come upon you. You are going to meet a presence. You are going to be utterly in the present. You're going to be inhabiting yourself in this world in a new way. Stop thinking about time. You're about to have a total upside down turning of your own senses. And then Jesus goes on to talk about space. That you will be my witnesses in Jerusalem, not far from where they are right then, in all Judea and Samaria and to the end of the earth. So Jesus wipes away this talk of history and instead starts to draw a kind of map. And I can imagine in the minds of these hearers, or I think we could think of the writer of Acts as trying to paint this picture of these hearers. And you can imagine in their heads, okay, the timeline's gone, history's gone. It's just them, the Spirit's coming to them. And then, boom, this dispersion, this spreading, these waves. It's almost like where they thought they were a point in time, now they're a point in space, and the ripples are going to come out from there. In my past couple of teachings, I've been adding sounds to create some shared sonic spaces to invite us in together. This week, I just want to have one sound. A sound that helps me imagine the shift from time to space in the minds of Jesus' followers. And that's the sound of a simple bell chiming in one point in place and space and slowly filling to the farthest limits we can imagine. The people this historian is writing for, they've not been to these places. This is a zooming back of the camera, which is to say, don't think about time, but start imagine the farthest place you could imagine, and that is where you're going to go. And you are going to be witnesses to transformation and power. So the historian is representing Jesus really here, blowing their minds, shifting their paradigm, of course, shifting them from a history and time-based approach to a space-based approach and being in the present in that space. And then the writer really kicks it up. Because once the hearers of Jesus here, and therefore the readers of this text, have fixed this expansive view of the universe in their mind, rolling out from the point in space in which they stand, then we read that when Jesus had said this, as they were watching, witnessing, he was lifted up, and a cloud took him out of their sight. So the dimensions are really multiplying here. It's almost like, to think of the analogy of the book maybe some of us have read as kids called Flatland, where we think about what's it like for a two-dimensional figure to live in a three-dimensional space. We can't always see all the dimensions we're in, and this passage is doing just that, saying, shift from the understanding of the temporal dimension to thinking of the spatial dimension. You could think of the two-dimensional map of the witnessing of God's power moving out across Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria. You could think of the circles going out on a two-dimensional map there. But then the writer depicts Jesus moving out of the map altogether. It's just such a great move, because then we're going from time to flat space to a whole other axis of space, which is to say, okay, now that I've opened your mind to thinking about the world in the way you hadn't before, and the Holy Spirit's presence in you in it, I'm now going to go up above that world, and now that you've expanded your definition of reality, I'm going to add yet another dimension, because that is God. God is bigger. No matter how big a reality we have in our minds, God is always bigger. And Jesus being lifted up is just that. Sure, Jesus lifted up is also Elijah in the chariot, perhaps his other figures from the Old Testament who were taken away. But I think here, in this historian's view, the key here is that Jesus lifts up to make us think that as soon as our mind is bigger to accommodate God's work, we also have to expand our view of God and where God is and what God is. So we will keep expanding our minds, but God will keep expanding as well. And it's great there we get this picture then of what did these disciples do in that instance while they stand there looking up. Because one thing we do is when the world gets bigger, we want to go there too. We want to be God too. There's a great picture there. They just had a map painted for them bigger than they'd ever heard of. They just heard that the Spirit was going to come upon them and send them into this world. And instead of being excited about that new dimension and spatiality, they want to know how can they go where Jesus went, because with humans it's never big enough. And of course these two men in white robes show up and say, why are you standing up there looking up there like that, getting them back into the work. And then our historian, our camera person, our director of our film takes us back to space and landscape, because as expanded as our minds might be, as large as our imaginaries and our imaginations might be to accommodate the world as big as it can be, we're still 2 feet on the ground, gravity pulling at us, dust around our toes. And at the end of the day, no matter what the mountaintop experience, there's a walking back to where you're going to sleep and eat. And so we read that they returned to Jerusalem from the mount called Olivet, which is near Jerusalem, a Sabbath day's journey away. Such a nicely framed passage here of saying they were in a particular landscape on a particular mountain, a particular distance away from a city everybody knows and still knows today. There's some concreteness to that, some physicality to that. As big as the imaginary of Jerusalem, Judea, and Samaria are, we're back now to the references we know. We have to use what we know to understand what we don't know. A Sabbath day's journey away. These disciples now had a vision Jesus had left them with of walking much farther than that, perhaps of a lifetime of walking. And the writer of this book is well familiar with these travels and wants to set out these travels and this dispersion of peoples, of the Spirit. But here we get a reference point, a Sabbath day's journey away. A day's walking, one little move against a lot more and bigger moves. And then it just gets ever more intimate. So we move from this huge map of a world with God even bigger than that above it to a Sabbath day's walk across a very particular landscape that the readers would have known, to these believers entering a city and going to a single room upstairs where they were staying. And there they all were, and they are named. The historian names them. Peter and John were there, and James and Andrew, Philip and Thomas, Bartholomew and Matthew, James, son of Alphaeus, Simon the Zealot, Judas, son of James. And all these were constantly devoting themselves to prayer, together with certain women, including Mary, the mother of Jesus, as well as his brothers. And so the historian, the camera person, the director says, you know, we love big views, but at the end of the day, we need a reference point. How far is it? It's one Sabbath day's journey. And at the end of the day, we need faces. Who was there? Where were they? They were in a room. They were upstairs. And I can name them. The camera can pan around and they are there. It's a beautiful juxtaposition to me, this sweep within a few short verses, a few short sentences of this vast history in this book, to move from people thinking about all of time and where they were in it, to Jesus inviting them thinking about all of space and the longest horizons they could see, to the scale of a significant day's journey, and the scale of a room of friends who love each other and who had been through so much, and who, the readers would know, would go on to do great works, each and every one of them. These were famous people. These were where it started, these women and men. And so I wonder if this historian's take on this beginning of such a magnificent story might not help us in our own questions about where we are in our story. Because as we each of us ask, when are we in history? When are we in the story of this pandemic? When are we in the story of this nation? When are we in the story of the church? When are we in the story of our own life? When will God show us the completion of the work? And just as then, in those early days, Jesus said, it's not for you to know when. Instead, think of yourself as in this moment, in the now, because the Holy Spirit is going to dwell in you in that moment. An abstract thing, yes, but an indwelling that has been well documented by stories in the book of Acts, as well as across the stories of this own church and your own stories. When are we in history? We're now, and the Spirit is in us, and the world has changed. Not just changing for the worse, as we see in the headlines, the ticking clock, the insistence on the end of time at every turn around us. The world has changed because the Spirit is working through us when we are now and where we are now. And in ripples that extend to all of space. And Jesus is with the Father above us all, not just in some abstract sense above the clouds, but God is bigger than all. The Spirit is with us throughout every space we can imagine, and God is bigger than all of that. I hope that's a source of worship as well as a source of comfort for you. I hope it gives you a break from the relentless questions of when. When, Lord, when? And if all that's too abstract, let's walk in our mind's eye from wherever we walk when we walk to the upper room of our own church at New Covenant. Walking to your bike and biking to church, walking to the car and driving to church, but then walking down the sidewalk, seeing faces on the way in, entering our front door and our lobby, walking up the stairs, as the historian takes us up the stairs, to the room where are the names that we know. And if the question of how the Spirit works in us now is too abstract, then the historian in Acts answers us by saying, here. It acts here, in these faces. The Spirit is acting now, in this, among us, in this room, in our own bodies, with this world beneath our feet, is where it all begins.